Hello, everyone. This is episode 49 of the iPhone Podcast. For show notes and to send us feedback, please visit theiphonepodcast.com. Once again, I'm your host, Gary Ng, from the from iPhoneinCanada.ca, and I'm here alongside Justin Louie. Hey, Justin, how you doing?
I'm very good. 2 weeks in a row that we're on schedule, so that's a nice start, and we got a lot to cover this week, so let's get to it.
That's a very nice start. I think after this, we should drop off for about 6 months.
Yeah, that would be about our MO.
Yeah. Okay. Once again, we have some news that we've rounded up that we thought would be interesting. Let's get started. First up here, there was a story here from Macworld. They noted that Apple is going to open a data center in Oregon. There's a huge, huge chunk of land in Prineville, Oregon, and Apple is planning to open a data center, the company said. Basically, this is a 160-acre piece of land that Apple bought for $5.6 million, and it was reported earlier by a local news channel. So, once again, Apple's opening up, or they're going to build another huge data center.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's not really news because it's kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that it's not like Apple will ever tell you what data center you're using or which they're using for which thing. But with their real big move, I think Steve Jobs said that the next 10 years would all be about iCloud. So between that and everything they're trying to do with Siri, they're going to need a lot of these, and it makes sense for them.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at the North Carolina data center, I mean, that data center is huge. And what I thought was interesting is when they were just, you know, local reporters that would try to get as close as they possibly could to the data center, and they were basically would act like spies just to get a glimpse of this building that is a huge data center storing all of our info.
Yeah, it goes to show you what big news Apple is nowadays. A few years ago, nobody would care if people were buying property or building data centers. But now, any little bit of news they can get or any little bit of exclusive news, everybody's falling all over themselves to try to get that next scoop.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about data centers and whatnot, I mean, back before Apple had built these data centers, you know, the talk was about Google and all their smaller sort of servers set up around the world to you know, ensure that they would always have uptime and whatnot. So I guess this is just a larger scale compared to what Google's doing. Let's move on to the next story. Apple has acquired Chomp, which is basically an app store search and discovery tool. And this acquisition is going to hopefully assist Apple in letting users find those new and must-have apps, or just any app, a heck of a lot easier than what we're doing right now.
Yeah, this one kind of surprises me because I figured Apple would do something like this more themselves. They don't, compared to other companies, Apple doesn't tend to buy a lot of companies, but we've discussed Chomp different times on the show. I really like it. I think they do a pretty good job of unearthing the kind of smaller apps that maybe aren't getting a ton of downloads but are getting a lot of good reviews. They're really good at finding the price drops right away. So with the sheer number of apps in the App Store, I do find that the store is getting a little dated. So if you take this acquisition plus the rumors a few weeks ago that Apple was in the process of revamping the entire iTunes store, this makes sense. They have to do something to make it a little easier to discover the whatever ridiculous number of apps that we're up to right now. They got to do something to make it easier to find, because the what's new and hot in the top 50 sale apps just aren't cutting it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Bloomberg actually reported that Apple paid $50 million for this acquisition. It was also noted by 95 Mac. They said that the actual upper level management from Chomp was already working at Apple, I mean, I tried out Chomp on the web. I haven't really tried the iOS app at all, but on the web, it definitely was a different way of letting you search for those apps that, just, you know, a regular search in the iTunes App Store would not let you find. Like, there were so many different categories, so many tags and keywords, actually made searching for apps quite easy. One of my favorite apps to sort of, you know, stay on top of what's sort of like trending and what's really hot right now is the app Kinetic, which I think we talked about before.
We did.
Basically, Kinetic just shows you what apps your friends have downloaded and which ones they've liked and recommended. And based on, I guess, that large survey of their user base, you can kind of tell which apps are the must-haves.
What I'm interested to find out about Chomp is when it first came out about a year ago, it was really good at discovering apps. It had all the categories and the searching and the sales, but it also had like a social network element where you actually created a profile and you could follow your friends, or you could also follow different tastemakers they had recommended users. And I actually really enjoyed that part of it, where I could either through friends of mine or just kind of tech people, famous people online, kind of see what they were up to. And then that's been removed recently. So I wonder if that was Chomp before Apple bought them, just saying, we're going to kind of leave that behind. We don't find the social networking part that interesting and we're moving away. Or was that a feature that they pulled because Apple was acquiring them? And that's something that Apple plans to kind of reintroduce into their own system. So I think the sales and the unearthing the popular apps is more important, but having something a little more social, iTunes Ping gets such a bad rap because Steve Jobs famously kind of overhyped it and it didn't kind of live up to what people were expecting. But I do find it's actually pretty useful for finding what people are listening to. And I think a similar service for podcasts and apps would be good. I think it'd be pretty cool for not only people listening to our show, but other people that we're interested in. If you could kind of just see a running tally of what they're downloading, it would, a lot of times that's how I discover apps. Somebody mentions on Twitter, oh, I'm enjoying this app right now. And then you go check it out. So I'm hoping they bring that social element back to Chomp once Apple fully incorporates it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there definitely needs to be a better way to find out what your friends are downloading. And a better way to share links to download those apps. Like, there needs to be some sort of social network or some sort of game center that involves, I don't know, people's Apple IDs. And, you know, if you enable your history or what you've, you know, your most recently downloaded apps, that would be kind of interesting to find out about your friends and stuff.
Yeah.
But something needs to change. And obviously, it sounds like something's going to be coming soon. I mean, We've seen Apple, I think, what was one of their latest updates? When they hired Michael Cart, he was basically this university student, and he was creating all these iOS concept videos. I don't know if you remember. He had one about setting up iMessage, actually, on OS X Lion. And lo and behold, we have Messages beta now, which, you know, we've been talking about for years. So it's always interesting to see what comes up when Apple acquires new companies or they have new staff or new little smaller startups.
Yeah, I think we'll see this quickly. My guess is you could even see it as early as the iPad announcement next week. And if not, then this summer with WWDC, I think they will announce or even just release the new. I think the rumors are true that there'll be a new iTunes store. It was great at its time. It's still good. I think it gets, again, a bad rap. I don't think iTunes is nearly as bad as some people make it sound. But with the fact that it started as a simple music store and now it has podcasts and apps and audiobooks and movies and TV shows, I think it is due to be cleaned up a little bit and easier for people to discover stuff.
Right on. Okay, next up here, let's give some our listeners a bit of a background about this app called Evy, which is basically almost like a Siri competitor. From what I've read about it, it during its initial launch, I think they were hammered by the amount of press that they received. So the app was basically similar to Siri, where you could ask it a question and it would formulate an answer. Now, fast forward, there was a story that Apple was going to be pulling this app because it had basically crossed some guidelines saying it was replicating the feature of Siri. But now a new report from The Verge says that, you know, Apple's not pulling this app. They're actually working with the developers to clarify the situation.
Yeah, I find this story a little suspicious. Apple's not known to warn developers. Apps tend to just disappear. I've also never heard of Apple working with developers, but the story does also suggest that this is a new policy, and they have done this recently, trying to work with developers before pulling an app. So I'm suspicious, but I guess it's possible. And I think overall, Apple's sort of moved away from that duplicate functionality type of thing. I think you see every day apps come out. There's phone apps, there's email apps, there's podcasting apps. You don't hear that many apps being rejected anymore for duplicating functionality. If anything, they're probably concerned about user confusion. Some people mentioned that it has some really similar features. I haven't used it yet, so I could see Apple maybe saying to the developer, hey, we're not going to pull you. We welcome the competition, but you can't be confusing users and making it sound like it's some type of Siri alternative or replacement, or some people even getting it, assuming it is Siri because it's a somewhat similar name and idea. So I think it's good for Apple. I don't think they need the bad PR, and nothing's going to be able to work as well as Siri, so they might as well let these apps in.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you take a look at the at Opera Mini, the web browser. You know, that was one of the earliest browsers, and people thought, oh no, you know, this would basically mimic the feature, the function of Safari. But as we've seen, most of these apps that come out that, you know, try to replicate Safari, the experience just isn't the same. And eventually people try them out and then they just stop using them or delete them.
Yeah, if any listener is at home using Opera instead of Safari, please Twitter me or email me and explain why, because it's just, I just don't understand it. I like some of the other browsers I've mentioned before. I actually use an app called iCab as much as I use Safari, but really that is Safari just with a new layer. It's using the WebKit engine. So in a lot of ways, it's just Safari with some extra features. I admire Opera for trying. I like that Apple's allowing other browsers. Competition's good. Maybe someday you'll see something that's a worthy competitor. But Opera, they're always bragging about these new speed improvements, but it's still slow. It's buggy. And as a web designer, it drives me crazy because it renders web pages so screwy. So I almost secretly don't want it to take off, because the last thing I want to do is to have to go in and debug all my pages to work on this goofy browser that seems to break the most standards compliant designs I've had. They don't have any issues, and somehow that browser tends to break them.
Yeah, it was just today at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, Spain, that Opera announced the final version of Opera Mini version 7 for iOS. And this new update actually has a couple of speed enhancements for the 4 and 4S. And a few other features. I re-downloaded the app just to, you know, give it a fair shot. And I'm still not a fan of the way it zooms into a web page. It's just kind of awkward. Also, like you mentioned, when it renders some certain web pages, it just doesn't look right. For example, Google, you don't get that Google mobile page. It's this weird sort of almost like WAP looking Google site. But I will give them credit. Being able to switch to a new tab and to have other tabs running in the background, that's pretty cool. Also, for those with limited data plans, using Opera Mini is just another way for you to just save data. So, I mean, I guess it really depends on the user at the end of the day, but I still find, you know, Safari is on top there. And I think, you know, they just need to work on that Zoom. It really, really bugs me.
Yeah. But again, it's good. There's other alternatives out there, but I'm not personally interested in it.
Okay. Next up here, this is a continuing story here that Apple is working on an enhanced A5 chip known as the A5X, and also a completely new chip, the A6, which is their quad core. There was a story here that says there was some information deep within the iOS 5.1 betas that referenced two separate chips. One would hint that one was the A6 chip and one is the A5X. Now, the quad-core A6 is rumored for the iPad 3, while some say the A5X is rumored for the next Apple TV. Originally, the story started out when MacRumors posted an image of an iPad logic board that had A5X on it. People eventually, I think it was McGadget, they mentioned that was from a prototype. Now we're seeing that there's evidence of two chips in the 5.1 beta. Just earlier this evening, All Things Digital, they noted that one of their security analysts said that the A5X is going to be possibly the next chip in the iPad 3. And the reason being is because the current Austin, Texas plant where all of these chips are made, it only right now is equipped to manufacture a 32 nanometer process. So basically, it's not equipped to manufacture a 28 nanometer quad core chip as in the A6. So, I mean, who knows what these analysts say? They're always full of lies. But the debate right now is the next iPad might not be quad core. It could be just a boosted A5.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. As I mentioned last week, I don't take any of these rumors seriously. The best case scenario is there's educated guesses that sometimes pan out. At worst, they're flat out lies for page views. As we've seen time and time again with Apple, they're working on multiple chips. They're working on multiple configurations. We've seen screenshots before of iPhones running 64 gig flash memory chips before that there was 64 gig phones, things like that. They're always testing things. I think we'll find out when it comes out. I found it funny that the article goes on at the end to sort of speculate, kind of here are the distinct possibilities. And I was wondering why they stopped at those possibilities. If you're going to play that game, the possibilities are endless. Like they mentioned, well, maybe the A5X is for an iPhone where the A6 is for the iPad. Well, why couldn't it be the opposite? Why couldn't the iPad ship next month with an i5X and the 6 is being held for the new iPhone? That's just as likely to me. So we'll find out whatever it is next week, but I do find it kind of funny that people are so desperate for Apple news that they'll keep reporting this stuff over and over again. And it's funny that something like chip size, RAM, memory, those type of things end up taking so many news cycles when really Apple or Apple consumers don't care about it. Apple barely mentions the chip when they announce the device. They've always, Steve Jobs has famously said, we're not in that typical PC arms race. Like, we want to make the great experience. So if you use an iPad 2 right now, there's never been a time you've launched something and said, oh, I wish this had more processing power. The thing is super fast as it is. And if they need a little extra juice to run a higher res display, then I'm sure this A5X will be plenty. So I'll find it interesting that if it gets announced next week and it is this dual core A5X, if you'll have people saying, oh, well, I'm not going to upgrade now because I was waiting for a quad core. Like, we didn't even have quad cores on computers a few years ago. What in the world do we need a quad core on an iPad for right now? Unless it has real advantages. Yeah, why not? But Apple Apple doesn't need to do it for the sake of doing it. As you've seen Samsung and HP and these other tablets, they went dual core before Apple did. And people were like, oh, well, it's a dual core, but the battery lasts an hour. Like, you, it's not a spec race with Apple. It's, can we keep making the device better, more powerful, while still maintaining the experience we've... No one's going to be happy if it has a quad core and LTE and the battery lasts 3 hours. So I don't think Apple... Whatever's ready will be ready, and at the end of the day, it becomes almost invisible because you don't live in the Apple world if you're buying on specs. It's just not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, the combination of a quad core chip and LTE in an iPad, I mean, seriously, as much as I'd love to have that, I honestly think it would just totally run against the mantra of trying to preserve battery, trying to have a processor that's even more efficient than before. Do we need a quad core chip right now? I don't know. What are the requirements to power the Retina display if it is coming? And that's, you know, it's rumored to be coming. And, you know, maybe the next iPad is, you know, going to be running Final Cut, some sort of Final Cut Pro version, or, you know, a more powerful version of Adobe Photoshop, or who knows, maybe it's going to be moved towards that, you know, the pro level, but we don't know. But, you know, there were also other rumors today that the prices of the iPad 3 could possibly be more expensive than the iPad 2 based on the speculation of the Retina display and an LTE-enabled iPad. Once again, just rumors.
Just rumors, and I don't buy that one either. It would be a major shift in the way Apple does business. Apple loves the announcement, here's what we've added, 1, 2, 3, 4, here's the 5 reasons this is so much better. Oh, and by the way, we've kept the price the same, which in some ways is a price drop when you're getting all those extra features for the same price. People always ask me, oh, well, Apple, do they ever have sales or do they clear this out? And I always tell people, no, they kind of keep steady prices, but every year it's like a price drop, because if you buy a MacBook Pro this year and then buy one next year, you're getting a significantly better machine for less money. Whereas on the PC side, you tend to see the new models selling for a significant premium while they try to clear out the old stuff, or they keep those cheaper models around. Apple doesn't normally work that way. So I can't see them standing in front and saying, here's the new iPad 3, and by the way, it's $50, $80, $100 more. I just don't see it. The only way that that could happen is if it became the opposite. If the rumors were true that they are going to introduce 2 new iPads, say an iPad 2.5 and then an iPad HD, maybe the Retina display they knew they had to produce, but it was significantly more. I think there's a slim possibility, but my guess is they've ramped up production to the point that they can add those new features for the same price. So if I was a betting man, I wouldn't be betting on a higher price.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at, you know, the price of the iPhone 4S and the iPhone 4, we actually had price drops for subsidized prices. If you were going to go talk about the iPad, I mean, like you said, Apple likes to, you know, have consistency when it comes to their prices and their updates. I mean, what happens is the rumor mill comes out with some crazy rumors. We have these sudden hyped expectations, and, you know, we know Apple's only going to do some sort of minor upgrade or have one sort of, you know, must-have feature that is the distinguishing feature between the iPad 3 and the iPad 2, whether it's the, you know, inclusion of Siri and the Retina display. I mean, hey, maybe that's enough for someone to jump to the next iPad. But I just I just think LTE and a quad core, I just don't think Apple needs to do that right now, as much as I'd want it.
Yeah, they definitely don't need to. And as I've said, I sound like a broken record, I've said it over and over on the show, is Apple doesn't play that game. Apple's going to do what they feel is going to give the best experience. We've seen in the past where at first you didn't have Skype and things like that on the phones, and Android or other manufacturers tried to tout that advantage before there was copy and paste, these basic features, Apple didn't rush them onto the market to try to compete. Just like you're not necessarily going to see a 5-inch and a 6-inch and a 7-inch and an 8-inch model just because that's what everybody else is trying. Apple is very comfortable with their position in the market. They do not do things for the sake of doing it. And that doesn't mean you won't see it down the road, but it's going to be on their schedule when they feel like they can give the most bang for the buck and not jeopardize the experience. I personally don't believe you're ever going to see Apple rush a technology and sacrifice the battery life or the usability or any of those things. So, and again, we had the whole Gizmodo iPhone 4 leak a few years ago, but since then, nobody had a clue Mountain Lion was coming out. Nobody had a clue last year about the smart cover with the iPad 2. Apple's still pretty good at keeping secrets, and they're so dominant right now in the iPad 2 market that if they announce next week basically an iPad 2.5 with very little difference, it's going to be, I'll tell you, I'll predict it right now, it'll be the exact same reaction from the blogosphere as the 4S. It'll be the sky is falling, this thing is crap, it's not that much better. And then a month or two later, Apple will start reporting all these record sales numbers. You remember last summer when that 4S was announced. I mean, people were just like, oh my God, this thing's not going to sell at all. It's just a minor upgrade. And it was Apple's most successful product of all time. They sold 37 million in one quarter. So we may see something revolutionary. I'm not leaning towards that myself, but I guess we'll find out next week.
Maybe it might be called the iPad 2S.
Could be.
But I'm surprised the original iPad wasn't called the iPad S. I guess that just can't do that.
Yeah, and even Apple is big as they are on their marketing. I don't think they obsess over things like that as much as some people. I think maybe, I mean, I expect it to be the iPad 3 no matter what. I think that's how they intend to keep the naming conventions. I've said a few times in the show before, I think eventually you may just see it called an iPad and an iPhone. They might get away from these different names. But for now, I guess this is a long-winded way of saying, I guess we'll find out next week, because I don't buy any of these rumors. So we'll find out hopefully next week. And I do think it's worth mentioning that it's Tuesday right now, or it's Monday night, but we're now into Tuesday, and there's still no announcement. So if it's next Wednesday, they usually give people about a week or a little more. So if
to wait until Tuesday or Wednesday then to...
Yeah, if we don't hear an announcement in the next day or two, then I say for sure that for once all things D got it wrong, and maybe we're not going to see an announcement next week.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, as we always say.
Yep.
Okay, this one here is a pretty interesting story. There were reports reported by The Daily, which is an iPad-only newspaper, that Office for iPad is coming. One of the editors of The Daily's story, he had a lead exclusive on it. He actually said that he saw a demo of Office for iPad. He shared a picture of the Office application icon. Basically, after he released the story, Microsoft comes out and says, you know, this is fake, it's not real, and then what?
Yeah, the thing I find interesting about the story just personally is that I read this story literally hours after we recorded last week when I said Microsoft better release it soon. And that's just a funny coincidence. And I do think that's still the story. I'm interested to see if and when it's going to come out. There's been some speculation since that maybe Microsoft is being so weird about the denial, non-denial, denial, denial, that maybe they're scheduled to show this off on stage next week and they don't want to have Apple mad at them.
Yeah.
So I think that's a possibility. I think it would be good for both companies. Some people are saying that, oh no, like I think even Gruber said he doubts that would happen because what does Apple need Microsoft for anymore? And they don't really, but there still are businesses and people tied into that Microsoft legacy that could use it. So it would be just one more advantage to the iPad if it had it. But from a Microsoft standpoint, they have to do this. And I think I said last week that I kind of think this year will be the year of the more professional level app. And I'm going to be very interested to see how all these various companies handle it, because they're worried about cannibalizing their existing business. If you look at something like Office, I think the cheapest you can get into Office is like a couple $100 for like a student edition, and you can pay up to $400 or $500 for Office. Well, they're going to maybe be able to get $20, $30, $40 max on the iPad.
So oh, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if they're willing to do that. And as we've discussed before on the show, I think moving forward, the smart companies like Apple and Netflix and things like that are the companies that are going to be willing to kind of kill off their old business to embrace the future. So if Microsoft is worried about an iPad version cannibalizing their desktop sales, then they're just going to lose either way. Because if they lose that name share in a few years, if everybody's just like, oh no, there's six other Office alternatives on iPad and they're all great, and Google Docs is still doing what it's doing, Microsoft can't count on the fact that right now, almost every human being is stuck at some point, your accountant, your lawyer, somebody at work, almost every, it seems like a couple times a year minimum, you're going to run into some situation where you have to work in the Word world. So if there was a nice cheap iPad version, I think Microsoft would sell tons of them, but they've shown a reluctance in the past. So I'm going to be watching this story closely because I think it's interesting.
Yeah, I think it totally comes down to pricing. I mean, you take a look at Apple's apps such as Keynote, Pages, and Numbers. Even just, you know, on the iPad, it's a universal download for $9.99. So, I mean, I can't see them charging $20 or $40 for a piece of software on the iPad. It's definitely going to have to be around in that, you know, $10 price point.
Yeah, well, when I said the 20, 30, 40, I meant if they're going to try to somehow, because I think the screenshot made it look like it wouldn't be individual apps. They're going to try to force you to buy the whole suite. So maybe instead of being two or three different apps, Microsoft Office would be Word, Excel, and PowerPoint in one app. I could see them selling it for any amount. If Microsoft released a credible version of Office on the iPad tomorrow for $150, they'd sell quite a few copies. There would be Microsoft people who are kind of forced to buy it, but it wouldn't take off in huge numbers. That's where I'm saying if Microsoft was smart enough to release something for 10, 20, 30 that was really a phenomenal product, they could not only make all their current users happy, people who are loyal to Microsoft on the desktop but want to have mobile access, and they could bring in a lot of new users because of their name and their experience in that department. So that's why I do think it's so interesting to see if these third-party companies, these former competitors with Apple, and even just some desktop companies that have kind of made their name on more expensive desktop stuff, if they're going to be willing to do, as we discussed last week, we were both impressed with the way EA didn't care about their old business. They're happy to sell games for $1, $2, $3 on the iOS store, and they're doing really well. So will other companies follow suit or continue to kind of quicken their own death?
Yeah, that is very true. I'm just thinking of another example, OmniFocus for the iPad and iPhone. I mean, they're still managing to charge $40 for the iPad version of OmniFocus. And out of 121 ratings, it's at like 4.5 stars. So clearly they've done the right thing and they've made a killer iPad app version of their original software that was for the desktop.
You bring up a really good point. We've discussed OmniFocus a few times, but really never discussed that aspect of it. I find their business model really fascinating. At some point, the people who run that company are really cool and they're really good with bloggers and podcasters. And I actually asked them for an interview several months back, and they were willing to do it, and we just haven't scheduled it yet. So at some point, I'd like to get someone on there from there, because they kind of do things the exact opposite of what we've praised in the past, which is charge 99 cents and millions of people will buy it. When they first released OmniFocus for the phone, they didn't know what to charge. And I remember seeing an interview with the CEO, and he said, our only basis of comparison was that we are charging $80 for it on the desktop, and things like Palm Pilot and BlackBerry and those type of apps that existed at the time, they tended to charge sometimes $50, $60 for an app. So they thought at $40 for the iPad and $20 for the iPhone, they thought that was a pretty low price. They thought they were being aggressive, but then the market quickly went down to the 99-cent app. And because they had initial success at $20 and they're sort of afraid of making their app like lose some of the value, they've never had a sale. They've never had any weird kind of gimmicks. That app's just been a straight $20. And on one hand, I think it really works well. You'll never meet somebody who uses OmniFocus and begrudges them the $20. Most OmniFocus users would say, I'd pay $50 for that app. I don't want to, but I would, even though I hesitate to spend 99 cents on other apps, I would pay $50 for OmniFocus. But at the same time, listeners and people who just come across it, they're not going to go, oh, let's just go drop $20. It's a bigger decision. So I find it interesting that they've continued to sort of stick to that price model and kind of go with a higher level app. Like if you look at OmniFocus for iPad, it's, to me, it's better than their desktop app. That's, I put that in the category of like GarageBand and iMovie and a few of these apps that are pretty much desktop quality apps, but on the iPad.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's impressive that they've stuck with their price point, no sales, and they're just booming right now. And they've been consistent with their updates. We've also had worked with them in terms of getting a review up for the iPhone app when it was first out. So kudos to the Omni group for sticking to their guns. It just goes to show that people will pay for a quality app.
And they jumped on it early and have stuck with it. Like you said, they were one of the first apps to come out for the iPhone originally. They continue to move their products over. Once they release them, they're constantly updated. And they committed at the end of last year that they are going to be bringing all of their apps. And that's another thing I like about them. They committed last year to bring all of their apps over, but since that time, not one has come out. They always say, we're in no rush. We don't release it until it's ready. And they're a perfect example of not everything has to be a throwaway 99-cent app. There is room for high-quality apps. And when people pay that money, it seems expensive at first, but when you see the depth and the quality of the app, it's tremendous.
Right on. Okay, now let's just move on to some app news. But before we do that, I wanted to touch base with Justin about a bit of a post that we talked about today about how out of North America, the only authorized carrier unlocker for iPhones is Rogers and Fido. No other carrier in the States or Mexico offers carrier unlocking of the iPhone. And for people listening in Canada, if you're a Rogers or Fido customer, they will unlock your iPhone that is branded Rogers or Fido. But there are some pretty strict stipulations. You must be near the end of your contract. Your account must be in good standing. Also, I think you need to pay $50 as well. So I've talked to quite a few users who have done it, and those who have managed to get it done, it's basically, it goes like this. You call Rogers, they confirm your IMEI, then they basically take your IMEI off this list of phones that should be locked. Then you just restore your iPhone on iTunes on your computer. And after it's restored, your phone is permanently unlocked.
For people new to the show, this is the portion of the show that Gary does every once in a while. He tries to bait me into going on a Rogers rant. Luckily for the listeners, he mentioned this pre-show and I went off. So now I'm more calm and collected, so you won't get the full bore. So in other words, with everything with Rogers,
there's no baiting here. This is just a discussion.
Like everything, it sounds good in theory. I have a reputation. Even some of the reviews have mentioned it now. I'm starting to get a reputation of being a Rogers ranter. The funny part is that I stick with Rogers, and every time somebody asks me who I recommend Rogers. I think that's part of the reason I'm so disappointed with them, because they do some of the dumbest stuff, but out of all the Canadian carriers, I still think they're the best. And this is another perfect example. So being one of the only carriers in the world to be able to unlock the iPhone, that's wonderful. $50 to me is a little bit of a kick in the face.
Already paid for the device.
You've already paid for the device, and you've spent thousands of dollars to make it through that contract. But even if I could live with that, because again, for our listeners outside of Canada, we just literally laugh at you when you talk about AT&T and Verizon and other companies, because you've never seen anything until you've seen the costs in Canada, the stupid little fees. You need some kind of degree to even figure out what your bill is. A Rogers bill is 5 pages long, and you would expect that for your call log. But even the first 2 pages is a couple pages. Your bill broken down into these 10 different little fees. So, I mean, we just get feed to death. So besides the $50, the part that's crazy to me is, so the 2 years in your contract sort of makes sense, because people could do some stuff, unethical stuff outside of that. The account being in good standing makes sense. If you owe them a ton of money, why would they unlock it? But the part that just kills me is if you finish your contract with them, or you upgrade your phone, so essentially you've paid out your old contract and you've started a new one, your phone isn't eligible for unlocking. They say it has to be an active phone. And if you call before, say you were smart enough to figure that out and you wanted to call the night before and say, okay, I'm going to buy a new phone tomorrow, so can you unlock this? They won't do it unless you meet all these other requirements. So to me, the most useful time to unlock your phone would be right when you do your old phone. I tried to unlock mine last year to either set it up for a family member or just to make it a little more valuable when I sell it. And of course, they wouldn't do that because they said, sorry, it's not on your account anymore. We can't do anything. So to me, that seems like Rogers hiding behind a little technicality for not wanting you to do that. So that's what bugs me about them, that they refuse to just earn your business based on good customer service and a good experience. They always are trying to lock you in or kind of come up with some sleazy way to do it. And again, it's not just Rogers, it's all of them here. And we're starting to have some competition. The government's starting to look at these things. So, I mean, think of when we started the show, or God forbid, look at when you started the blog. I mean, we've come a long way, but we need to come a lot further when it comes to fairness. So I guess to conclude, I would say cool that Rogers is one of the only carriers in the world that has this access, but their stipulations and their little, to me, kind of unethical approach to it sours the whole deal, really.
Yeah, I definitely think there should be a history of your iPhone's IMEI that says this was a Rogers phone that you signed up with 3 years ago and you finished your contract, but you've now moved on to another device. We see that. We're going to unlock it, but it'll still cost you $50. Now, I've talked to a couple readers who have managed to sort of get a workaround to this. Basically, let's say, you know, you had a phone that you no longer use with Rogers, but it's an iPhone. What this user did was he ended up giving it to his brother to hook up to his postpaid account, his monthly account, and waited that minimum of 30 days, so the phone that was in the system for 30 days. Once that phone was in there for 30 days, then he asked Rogers to unlock it. Since it wasn't, on a contract basis, they agreed, and boom, there you go. Unlocked iPhone. Now, the one thing that really gets me about, you know, some of your rant or just, you know, the industry today is how caller ID, the one feature, is like $11 or $12 caller ID. I remember being a Fido customer way back when they were still part of the Microcell. No, I can't remember, but before they got bought out, I remember caller ID was only like $2 or $3 as an add-on, but now it is somehow magically jumped up to like $8 or $9 or $10 for caller ID. It boggles my mind.
Well, it's just, that's another example of their sort of, to me, anti-consumer pricing practices. Part of the reason it's $11 or $12 is because they then say to you, oh, well, sir, our value pack at $25 that includes caller ID, visual voicemail, 500 megabytes of data seems like a steal. But if you're legitimately someone, I remember at the time years ago trying to get my grandmother a cell phone, when you wanted, like, she doesn't know what visual voicemail is, we just want her to be able to have caller ID, you couldn't get it at a proper price. So there are people that kind of discriminates against, but again, that's just a pricing gimmick so they can hit you with the value pack. What's a little frustrating for me with Rogers right now is I actually have a plan that I'm paying for a couple features twice because of kind of having to add. Some of them are part of this new, I don't even know what they call them, but they kind of have these voice and data and a few features kind of plant, like, you know what I mean? They've put a package deal together with these things, but then it doesn't have, say, I think it's mine, it doesn't have visual voicemail. So then I actually
have one feature you want.
Yeah. So then I have to buy that other value pack so that I'm actually paying for certain things twice and they give you certain credit. So it worked out that my overall bill was better the last time I made a plan, but it's still silly that I'm looking at my bill, I think paying for, I think it's unlimited texts and caller ID that I'm actually paying for twice because of the way these screwy plans work. I wish they could just say, here's the amount of minutes, here's this thing with, and either include it all free or have one value pack that's everything. But as I mentioned before, it's a million times better than it was just 4 or 5 years ago. So hopefully that trend continues.
Okay. I think that was pretty satisfying for me to listen to that. Let's move on. Let's move on to some app news. Here we have Adobe, which has come out with a pretty powerful app here, Photoshop Touch for the iPad.
Which is, if you notice, I strategically put right after the Microsoft story because it would lead nicely in, but you had to interrupt it with baiting me for a Rogers rant. So skip that last couple minutes and we can go right back in. Adobe is another example, almost identical to Microsoft, where a company that's made their hay on selling big, slow, bloated $400 apps, and now they're moving over to the iPad. And just as rewind what I said about Microsoft, and I'll say the same thing about Adobe, I'm really fascinated to watch what they do over the next few years to see if they're smart enough to bring their apps over. Now, this Photoshop Touch, I've only had a few hours to use it, and I really think the reviews are going to hinge on what you're expecting from it. If you're comparing it to other photo apps in a similar price range on the iPad, then it is remarkable. Some of the layering and some of the techniques you can do are incredible for a $9.99 app. But then it has some major limitations, like it will not export just a plain Photoshop like PSD file. It has this unique PSDX file that has limitations on the size, and it doesn't work right now with some of the other Photoshop or Adobe apps. It only works with the newest version, I think CS5 version of Photoshop, which is like a $400 app. So it's a good first step. I'm amazed at some of the functionality. Perfect example. Here's the best example I can give for people who aren't real big into this type of stuff. Everybody's had a photo at some point where it's a nice, say, photo of yourself and you're standing in front of a McDonald's and you want to use that with a transparent background for a website or some type of other thing. So you want to cut out the background. Well, a couple years ago, you would have needed a college degree and a $400 copy of Photoshop to figure that out. In the last few years, like since then, it's become more of an automated process in things like Photoshop, but it works kind of so-so. This app has a new thing called a scribble tool where you scribble around what you want to keep and you don't have to do it very accurate. You can just kind of circle, say, the head. Then you kind of do another rough scribble around what you want to do, and it works its magic. And it is phenomenal how fast it works and how good. I did one of their tutorials last night of a lion, and even like every little tiniest bit of the fur on the lion was perfectly cut out. So just to have that kind of ability on an iPad is pretty amazing. So I would say if you're a Photoshop user and you want to do some of what you do, bring some of your workflow on the go, then $999 is a no-brainer. And if you're someone who has never obviously wanted to spend $400 on Photoshop but want to try some of the stuff, it's pretty cool. So I would say at this point, it's a really good first move. And then moving forward, I will be interested to see if Adobe will continue to push the app, improve the app, have more export options, or are they going to be afraid of losing $400 Photoshop on the desktop sales and sort of cripple their own app? And it's the same as we discussed with Microsoft and Avid and some of these others. It's, will these companies be smart enough to realize that this is the future, and Apple should be the example that it's a halo effect? Maybe you'll lose a few sales of your desktop program because somebody buys the iPad version, but maybe somebody ends up loving the iPad version so much and then buys your desktop app. So I think they'd be dumb to do that, but this first app is a good start.
Yeah, I mean, so far, early reviews, people have been quite impressed with Photoshop Touch. It's probably, you know, quite the achievement for Adobe after, you know, the failure of Flash to make its way onto iOS. At least, hey, we have Photoshop Touch. Moving on here, this one for all those old gamers, Midway Arcade.
Yeah, I put this one in because you and I are both on record of liking classic games. We've both been critical of Nintendo for not doing something like this. And about a year ago, I think, on the podcast, we discussed in great length, Atari had a similar app where you could download the app for free. It had one game included for free, and then you could buy a value pack of all the games for like $15.99. And I think individual games were like $1.99 or $2.99. The graphics and the playability were all pretty terrible. We also reviewed Capcom did something similar, and it was neat, but again, kind of expensive to unlock all the games, and the games didn't play that well. And now we've seen another classic company try this again, and Midway is doing it a little differently. The app actually costs 99 cents to get going. Then it has six apps inside that you can unlock, and instead of selling them individually, they're 99 cents each pack. So you can unlock three games for 99 cents. So for $3, you could unlock all the games. And I've downloaded it, and but I haven't had a ton of time to play with it, but I was pretty impressed. The first thing you'll notice is it's actually the arcade versions. It's not like, say, the Super Nintendo or Sega Genesis versions. It's the actual arcade graphics and sounds. And even though you're still stuck with that sort of virtual joystick, I found the games that I played worked pretty well. And the other neat thing is it really takes the arcade metaphor pretty far. Not only does it have these video games, but it has air hockey and pool and that basketball game where the baskets just keep coming down the ramp and you shoot them. And those are kind of fun for a couple minutes. So if you're into old classic games, I would say it's a no-brainer. For me, it includes Rampage, which is a mindless game where you're this big gorilla or the big Godzilla-type monster and you just basically smash buildings. Totally mindless game, but that I always found really fun when I was a kid. And it also has a game called Arch Rivals, which was like the early version of NBA Jam. And probably most people don't like it compared to NBA Jam because it's slower and doesn't have all the pop-up, like all the power-ups. But I actually find it's actually a better game. It takes more skill to play. You can't just kind of use those special moves. There's some strategy to it. And that was a game that a couple buddies of mine when I was a kid, I can't tell you the number of hours we played Arch Rivals on the NES. So a couple of fun games in there. And as an example of these kind of classic games, I think it does a really good job compared to what we've seen before.
All right. I'm going to mention one app here. Let's talk about the Vimeo update. Vimeo updated their video app for the iPhone. It's now a universal app that includes iPad support. This was announced today. The iPhone UI also has a bit of an update as well. I haven't had a moment to download it for the iPad yet, but Vimeo has been working really hard. One of the first video sharing sites to adopt HTML5 for their videos, and basically all Vimeo embeds are watchable on iOS devices, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I love Vimeo, and their iPhone app was decent, but this new revision with the iPad interface is fantastic. It adds the ability to shoot, upload, edit videos. It has a bunch of things from that standpoint you can do that I haven't had a chance to look at yet. But the thing that I love about the new iPad version is two killer features. It allows you to view all your subscriptions and your queue. So what you can do is when you're surfing around the internet on your desktop computer or you're on the Vimeo site, you can hit watch later on any of the videos or any of the embeds. And then when you go to your iPad, you can instantly look at your queue and watch all the videos that you have queued up. And the other cool thing about the iPad layout, and you don't normally see this, is you can watch a video and still navigate the app. So it has this really nice interface where the video is down in the bottom right-hand corner. And you, of course, can make it full screen if you want. But if you want to just watch and listen to that video while you're manipulating the site, looking for more videos, searching, doing something else, it allows you to do that. So Google should be watching. I find Vimeo, it isn't obviously as popular as Google because to do most of the stuff, you have to have a paid account. It's more of a kind of a paid high-end version of YouTube, but it's so superior with its app and its layout and everything that I hope Google's watching, because to me, this is now the premier app for this type of like social or whatever you want to call it, video.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about one app update that occurred maybe I'd say a couple weeks ago, and that's the popular sort of GPS driving app Waze. Waze has support for both Canada and the USA specifically. And essentially how it works is you just, you know, as you're driving, you're using the app and you can, you know, based on the power of its users, you can see, you know, any sort of traffic updates that are happening in real time, whether it's an accident or whether, you know, which routes are heavy on traffic, which ones, you know, are totally backed up. You can report any sort of speed traps, accidents, any sort of issues. Also, it includes talk to text, which is a big bonus, and it uses your data plan, so there's no downloading of any maps. I think there's a really good sort of, it's really fully featured considering that it's free, free talk to text, and there's a night mode, day mode. You can plan your trips. Really simple interface to be able to quickly use it while you're in the car. So that's Waze.
Yeah, I haven't used it recently, but I'm thrilled that it's getting such good reviews, because I remember downloading it when it first came out, and it was because it was all using user generated content and maps and waypoints and all those things, it was pretty limited what it could do. And I think we even said at the time that it's a great idea, and if people embrace it, it can be something special. And people have embraced it, and I've heard people say that the updating things with like traffic and accidents and things is often better than some of the more expensive professional apps. So I don't personally really ever use GPS, but I'm going to download it again just to try it out. But I'm thrilled that a community free project, I'm such a big believer in these type of things, I'm glad to see it working out.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I just can't believe the value that is available for an app that's free. The app's success is based on its user base. So the more people that get their hands on Waze, the more effective it is. And like you said, I think we talked about Waze when it first launched, and you know, it required a lot of people to sign on. And I was shocked at the amount of updates that I was able to just, you know, find when I was just using it just to, you know, drive around town just to test it out. I was pretty surprised and pleased. So let's move on. We have time for one more quick update, and that is screens.
Yeah, I can't believe how long the show is going again. I said to Gary before the show that I thought this was going to be a rough week. We wouldn't have very much news. So we'll leave more time for apps next week, I promise. I know a lot of people, that's why they tune in. So next week we'll do probably an iPad 3 announcement, hopefully. Then after that, we'll get back to doing our own app picks and leaving more room for that. This final update, Screens, is definitely worth checking out. Basically, Screens is a VNC app that basically lets you access your desktop computer on your iPhone or your iPad. I've pretty much tried them all. There's a lot of great apps out there that do this. I know the prices can vary. I think there's free versions with very limited access. Maybe while I'm talking, Gary can look it up. I can't even remember what Screens is right now price-wise, but I think it's pretty competitive. But the killer thing about this new version is it was already my favorite app for this type of thing beforehand, but they have now just nailed the user interface, including if you're using, say, Lion on your Mac. So with this app, super easy. You download a free little client onto your Mac. It does all the tough setup work for you, and then you launch the app either on your iPhone or your iPad, and next thing you know, your desktop screen is on your iPad, and even if you're using things like a hidden dock and full screen mode, which screws up every other VNC client I've had, these guys have these new gestures where you pull on the screen to the left and hold it for a second, and then your invisible dock shows up. You can do a three-finger swipe to move through your spaces. So if you're like me and you've totally bought into Lion and you have five or six apps all running in full screen, you can access the launch pad. So it's the first VNC client that I'm aware of that fully embraces all of the gestures for not only the iPad, but for the Mac. And it's just incredible what you can do. I find myself using it all the time. I'm laying in bed and I want to check something on my computer. And the other new feature they added, I shouldn't gloss over this because it's huge, is you can now set up a username and password so you can access your computer even while you're not on your home network. So you can be out and be on your 3G connection and access back to your computer. And when you access your computer over 3G, you're victim of how good your connection is. It can sometimes be a little laggy, but if you're on your home network, it feels like using your Mac right on your iPad. There's almost no lag. It's really phenomenal.
Okay. Yeah. Back to the pricing of Screens. It's $19.99. On the topic of similar apps like this, I've actually started using LogMeIn, which is a free alternative. And it basically offers similar functionality, basically access your Mac or PC right from your iOS device. So far, LogMeIn as a free version, it's worked out great for what I've used it for, full control of my Mac. So LogMeIn is a free alternative to Screens for those who are looking.
I'm glad you brought that up because that actually happened while we were away. So we didn't cover that. Yeah, LogMeIn is a very big company in this market that always had like a $20 or $30 version, and then they changed their app to free and a free version. So you find the free one has most of the features?
For someone who doesn't connect to their Mac from their iPhone or iPad a lot, just using this as my first experience with this in a long time. Back then I used to use like GoToMyPC or something like that. But that was just straight from a browser. But from an iPhone or an iPad, LogMeIn works phenomenally well. I'm pretty impressed with it considering that it's free, and I highly recommend everyone check it out. It gives you basically just full control of your Mac. It's great.
And another thing I'll mention really quickly, maybe we'll go into it in more detail in a future show, but another app kind of like this, but it adds another element, is everyone's probably aware of like Parallels and VMware Fusion, these apps that allow you to virtualize Windows on your Mac. The latest version of Parallels not only runs Windows 7 well enough that it's like you're on an actual PC. It's amazing how fast that has gone. So instead of having to use like, say, boot camp and log into Windows. If you're desperate, you have some work app or something you need Windows for, Parallels does a really good job. And they have a VNC client built in now. So if you download Parallels for the iPad, you can not only be running Windows on your Mac, you can also access your Mac. And in the incredible thing is you can even access the Windows on your iPad. So if you think of all that virtualization going on, you wouldn't think it would work that well, but somehow my Mac is capable of running Windows virtually, then sending it over to my iPad and still work pretty. I freaked a few people out just showing them my screen all of a sudden saying, look, I have Windows installed on my iPad, and it freaks people out. And I cannot believe how well it works. I will mention that I think my iMac has 12 gigs of RAM. So that helps the cause, but I'm pretty amazed how well Parallels has got at virtualizing another OS, and now to be able to send over a virtualized operating system over to your iPad. It's one more example. I think the theme of the show has been the iPad is no longer this cool little thing for playing Angry Birds and reading comic books. It's becoming a pretty powerful work machine.
Yeah, what I found really, really interesting about LogMeIn was that even from my iPhone or iPad, the being able to use my finger as the mouse, it was very, very accurate controlling my MacBook desktop, even when it came to, you know, clicking on certain like text entries or whatnot. It was very accurate just, you know, being able to navigate around the computer. So I guess it does depend on your internet connection, but for something that's free, it's something that I think everyone should have. So that's LogMeIn. Okay, so once again, I'd like to thank everyone for listening to the iPhone podcast. This is a public service announcement. We're asking everyone to please rate us in iTunes. It means a lot to us, and not only that, it helps our show. We recently had a run-in with some artwork issues with Apple, and that had us sort of taking a little bit of a break to fix that issue, but now we're back. So any ratings you may give us in iTunes, whether they're positive or negative, we want your feedback, so please do that. You can follow the show and provide feedback by visiting theiphonepodcast.com or by following us on Twitter. I'm at twitter.com/iPhoneInCanada. And Justin is at twitter.com/JustinLouis. So once again, thank you for listening, and have a great evening, day, night, or morning.